Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power and shine a light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems instead of defending positions. This is a different show today. We're going to have a meta view on our current situation, or as we like to call it, situation. You know, as our attention is drawn out there to the latest news or latest speculation or latest commentary about COVID-19, information given that's supposed to safeguard our health is maybe making people more stressed and consequently less healthy. The question is not so much how do we tune that information out, but how do we attune ourselves in to the resources that are going to help us process this information in a helpful and healthy way? Well, longtime meditation teacher, practitioner, and author Philip Goldberg has a new book that just couldn't be more timely. It's called Spiritual Practice for Crazy Times. And anyone who doesn't think these are crazy times has got to be nuts. Anyway, Philip has been studying the world's spiritual traditions for more than 50 years as a practitioner, a teacher, and a writer. He's the author or co-author of more than 20 books, including The Intuitive Edge, Get Out of Your Own Way, and Road Signs on the Spiritual Path, Living at the Heart of Paradox. His 2010 book, American Veda, From Emerson and the Beatles to Yoga and Meditation, How Indian Spirituality Changed the West, chronicles the remarkable influence of India's traditional spiritual teachings on people here in this country and the West, and it was named as one of the top 10 religion books of the year by both Huffington Post and the American Library Association's book list. His most recent book prior to this one, published by Hay House, was The Life of Yogananda, the story of the yogi who became the first modern guru. He also appears on screen in the award-winning documentary Awake, The Life of Yogananda. He is a screenwriter and a published novelist. This is next year, being the book. We can say a word about that later. And he's also an ordained interfaith minister, spiritual counselor, and meditation teacher trained in 1970 by Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, 50 years ago. Now, I have to be honest, Phil and I go back a long, long ways, since before I actually knew him. We both attended John Marshall Junior High School 210 in Brooklyn at the same time. And even though I didn't know him then, we did grow up in the same spiritual tradition as Brooklyn Dodger fans. That was our great spiritual tradition. I've had a chance to go through Phil's prescriptions for creating, quote, a sane asylum during these crazy times, and they're filled with humor, down-to-earth practical wisdom, and uncommonly commonsensical practices. Welcome, Phil.
Hey, Steve. Good to be with you. Thanks for the kind introduction.
Yeah. We're brothers from different families. Now, obviously, you began working on this book a while back, and it's just so interesting that it's coming out at a time of even more external stress. Yes. Did you have some kind of premonition, or what sparked your writing this book?
Had I known that the crazy times we were living in when I started writing it would become this crazy, I would have written it faster and made sure the actual book was out by now. But we just knew times were crazy when I started writing it more than a year ago. And when it was scheduled for publication in the normal course of, you know, how long things take, we scheduled it for August, knowing things would be crazy then with the lead up to the election. And then the pandemic hit, and I'm grateful that my publisher, Hay House, saw that the book had value for people now, and so rushed the electronic version out, the ebook, the Kindle or whatever device you read on. It can be downloaded now for only $1.99. They wanted to make it as accessible as possible. The paper book, the actual physical book, won't be out until August. Can't rush those things, but we could rush the ebook. So go on.
Your timing is good. And, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that people could now go online and either pre-order the print book or download the ebook.
Can they find it at your website? Because that's what we link
they'll
to.
They'll find a link to it.
Perfect. So what got you started writing this particular book? You obviously just published, 2 years ago? You published a book on it's a great book, your book on Yogananda. It's hard to follow an act like Autobiography of a Yogi with a biography, but you did it. And it's a very informative book. And then pretty much after that, how'd you get the idea for this book? And
well, we were living in crazy times. Ever since the 2016 election, things have just gotten crazier. And I just kept running into people in my work and my research and everything who were having a very difficult time dealing with world events. Deeply spiritual people suddenly, saying things like, oh, they stopped doing their spiritual practices because the world's so crazy or they're so agitated. And I wrote a blog at one point about, 14, 15 months ago, talking about the importance of maintaining spiritual practice, even though things were crazy, that it's the very fact that things are crazy is an argument for doing one's spiritual practice even more conscientiously, for two reasons, not just for self-protection, but for also having a better platform for effective action in the world. So I wrote this blog. And I'd been talking to my publisher or my editor about, what to do next. I said, maybe there's a book in this, in the blog. And so that's how it all started. And just thinking, well, this is the age of Trump and things are crazy and they're going to continue to be. So let's write a book that will help people, regardless of what's going on outside, never dreaming that it would get this crazy. And right before we had to pull the curtain on any more revisions, we went into quarantine, to a large extent in the early days of this. And I said, do I want to change anything in the book because of this? And I realized, no, everything pertains to any time life is crazy for anybody. And I just added a one paragraph addendum in the preface. So I don't think I was prescient. I just think we all knew things were crazy, but we didn't know how just how crazy.
Exactly. Yeah, remember we said things couldn't get any worse? Well, we were cheer up. Yeah. Things could be worse, and we were right. Because obviously, and one of the things I loved about your book is one of the things you point out is that, this human beings being on this planet are always in a state of flux and change and uncertainty and crisis. And so this book is going to be evergreen from here on in. It's going to be useful for people.
Yes. Also, our definition of crazy is changing by the minute.
Yes, I guess you might have to update one thing. Maybe the next version is in crazier times, you can actually do an update.
Yeah, really.
you and I spent our deformative years in the same neighborhood, similar backgrounds, the only yogi we ever knew was Yogi Berra, even though he's on the other side, right?
Yes, he was the lovable enemy.
The lovable enemy. But think about it. You know, Yogi Berra wore the number 8. When he slid into a base, he would flash the infinity sign. Now, that was very metaphysical.
That's very true.
But anyway, I'm curious about your journey. You know, in your bio, it said that you began doing transcendental meditation 50 years ago in 1970. What was it that took you from the streets of Brooklyn to being interested in this very, I would say, exotic religious path?
Well, I never saw it as religious. I'm one of those people who identifies more with the word spiritual. I was never very – I grew up in an anti-religious household, so religion has a different meaning to me, but I take yours. I will make one correction. I started practicing meditation in 1968. I became a teacher in 1970. Two and a half years later. I grew up. I went to college. I left. I moved to Boston to go, do different things in graduate school and everything. And I was a child of that era, starting in the mid 60s, when things really started to change, when drugs and psychedelics came in. And in 66, 67, I was living in the East Village, and, the Hare Krishnas were there. And, I was a political activist. I was, marching against Vietnam War. I was running a SDS chapter in my school. I went down south to register African-American voters after the Voting Rights Act. I was very involved politically, but internally, I was a mess, and I just didn't know how to live life. I was very confused. I was very angry. I was doing everything I could to stay out of the draft, which your younger listeners may have heard of, when young men were being drafted and Vietnam was raging. And so I was making foolish decisions. But there was an energy of seeking and searching going on. I wanted truth. I wanted real answers to what was going on in the world and how to live a fulfilled and happy life. And I took some drugs. I had some tastes of inner peace and expanded consciousness. And somehow in the zeitgeist, people started talking about Eastern philosophy, what we think of as Hinduism and Buddhism and Taoism, all of which have certain things in common. And somehow I resonated with all that. I resonated with the books of Alan Watts and Aldous Huxley, and then I read the Bhagavad Gita for the first time and Upanishads, and it all started to make sense. Zen made a great deal of sense to me, and I don't know why. I don't know what it was about me and that segment of my sort of counterculture friends and colleagues that were drawn to these teachings, but they all made sense. And of course, when the Beatles went and learned to meditate and went to India with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, that put everything on the front pages. And I have to confess, I thought I was so hip that the Beatles doing it was a turnoff. But it did make me more aware of everything. And so eventually I started experimenting with different practices, Zen and yogic practices, and I took to TM, Transcendental Meditation, and I became a teacher of it, and that set me on a path of where those teachings, those core teachings of what we think of as Eastern philosophy, or more specifically Vedanta and non-dual Buddhism, and all those teachings just have became the way I look at the world. It's my lens on the world. My practices and everything have changed over time, but there's a certain consistency. And it just held up and has value to me and to the present day. And so it's become part of not just how I see the world, but how I then interpret the world in my writing and public speaking and all that.
How would you describe the conceptual frame that actually allowed you to see the world differently when you were exposed to these to the Vedic principles and so on? You know, coming from this confusion, yeah, secular culture, etc. What was there, like an aha, like a certain concept, a certain frame?
I'd say it's a combination of things. We were already turned off of materialism. It was already some of the core teachings of, like, you know, the first noble truth of Buddhism, that all of our attention to the outer world, trying to find happiness in these pursuits, the pursuits of sensory pleasure, the pursuit of money and prosperity. It was so obvious looking around us in those days that that's not what makes people happy. There were just too many miserable people doing everything they were supposed to do. But we didn't know that there was the later teachings of there's a way out of this. And that's where the Eastern teachings came in. It turns the attention around from the outer pursuit of looking for happiness and love and fulfillment in all of the wrong places. It turns you inward. And so that's why it always seemed very practical to me. These teachings are called mysticism. But I remember reading a book on mysticism and turning to my roommate and saying, why do they call this mystical? It seems perfectly rational to me. And that's how I still feel. There's a certain pragmatism and empirical grounding to these teachings. They tell you, go within, here are these methods. Here's this vast repertoire of yogic practices, of meditation practices, and all these, the rest. Do them and see if they work. And if they work, then continue to do them and forge your own repertoire and your own path. It's a practical teaching. And the philosophical grounding of it then begins to make sense if the techniques themselves work and you become transformed from the inside and you become a better person, you become a happier, more fulfilled person. That's what happened, and that's how these teachings entered the mainstream. That's why now your healthcare provider will tell you to do yoga and meditate, because these things work, whether you've see them in a spiritual context or as a psychology of consciousness or as just mental or physical interventions for well-being. And that's how they worked out. But philosophically, it framed how I saw the world from the inside out, so to speak, that the critical thing was our inner state. And then what we bring to the world will have its impact on the world and change the world for better or worse. And the big factor to me philosophically was that everything is connected.
We got to stop that, right there, because we have to take a break, Phil. We'll pick up from everything being connected. We have to be connected with our commercial messages. We'll be back after these with Phil Goldberg, and we're going to be talking about how to go sane in a crazy world. We'll be back shortly.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization Their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
A social distancing tip.
While the CDC urges you to avoid close contact, like hugging or shaking hands, there are other non-physical ways to say hello. Wave, wink, use sign language, salute, smile, give the peace sign, throw up an air high five, do jazz hands. Remember, stay a minimum of 6 feet or 2 arms length away from others, and stay home if you can. For more info, visit coronavirus.gov.
Let's all do our part, because we're all hashtag alone together. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Okay, we're back with Phil Goldberg. We're talking about his new book about how to stay sane in crazy times. You know, you just really was talking about your own experience, but your book, American Veda, really talks about the experience of many, many people. How and why Eastern spirituality appealed to the counterculture sensibilities in the late 1960s and 1970s, from Ram Dass, Be Here Now, to on and on to all of the other various gurus who showed up. Say more about that appeal from 50 years ago, and how has this evolved over the past decades?
You're making us feel old, Steve.
Well, you know what? You're only as old as how many times you've been reincarnated. So
okay. Well, first, let me say that American Veda focuses a lot on that era because it was so instrumental in this process, this transmission of teachings from the East into the heart of American consciousness. But the whole story goes back a lot further, and I start in the early 19th century when and then the mid-19th century with people like Emerson and Thoreau, and I bring it into the present. So it's a long history, but the 60s, what we think of as the 60s and 70s, and the arrival on our shores of a parade of gurus, many of whom became household words, and the advent of mass media, the counterculture, the embrace of the hippie generation, the Woodstock generation of these teachings. It all fit very well. Speaking of Woodstock, you know, one of the seminal events at Woodstock, which is now coming on to the 51st anniversary, was that Swami Satchidananda gave the opening address before, you know, all the music started and the rains came and everything else. He was up there giving an address and chanting some Sanskrit. I mean, so it was part of the culture at that time, as symbolized by that and by the Beatles going to India and similar phenomena and Ram Dass. This transition from the mind expansion of drugs, which had its dangers, to the safer and more predictable forms of inner work that the Eastern traditions offered for many people was a wise and sensible alternative. And what came out of all that was vast numbers of people of our generation learning these practices and seeing the world in a different way. But then what happened is because of that, scientists said, what the hell is going on here with these youngsters meditating and doing yoga and chanting and all this? And so they started doing research, and the research demonstrated predictable, quantifiable changes in the brain and in the body when people did these practices. So that's how the mainstream entered into it. And by the mid-70s, there were tons of scientific papers published. And then the emphasis, then you started seeing cover stories in magazines that weren't about hippies learning to meditate. It was about their parents, you know, you finding meditation and yoga and all these things as a better alternative to Valium or, you know, antidepressant meds and blood pressure meds and all this. So that it was a phenomenal time in history. And this, the current data that show people leaving conventional religion and but not giving up on spiritual, the inner work of spirituality and how we relate to the larger cosmos, this phenomenon of people being spiritual but not religious, I think owes a great deal. It can be traced directly to that time period when the spiritual practices that were born in the East. There's a lot of attention on mindfulness. Well, that's a Buddhist meditation practice. All the other meditation practices, they're largely from the Hindu tradition being adapted and secularized. And that, I think, is a phenomenon that people are not fully aware of how important it is, but it's what I try to bring out in American Veda.
You know, I remember at 1971, late 71, 72, I was in Santa Barbara, California, and I came upon this article about the science of creative intelligence. And that's what got me initiated into TM in 1972. Yeah. You know, because all of a sudden it was being studied as a phenomenon that could be that the West could relate to as a mediating force between a civilization that has no cosmology, that disconnected from the world largely. I mean, you know, science and religion are they don't talk to each other. And so this was really a very interesting and powerful bridge. So to bring us up to the current moment, let's talk a little bit about what's in the book and what did you find? Because I know that you obviously had to go and say, well, what do I do? What do I do when I want to create inner peace? How did you go about finding the tools or reminding yourself of the tools?
Well, you know, a lot of them were part of my own repertoire, but then I had to go expand a little further. So I did some research. I looked at what other people were saying and teaching. I had spent a lot of time. I had a whole lot of notes and things in my files on my computer and in my file drawers that ended up being in this book. That I would put there, not knowing how I would use it, but knowing it might be relevant to something I would write one day. So I had been gathering all that. And in the course of researching American Veda and my biography of Yogananda, you know, I found many more things, all of which, you know, plus some new things I looked into, ended up being in this book, which is a very practical book, unlike American Veda or Yogananda's book, which are more about history and the larger picture. I wrote a very practical book this time out. And the primary point of view was something that we just talked about that I learned back in the 60s and that has held up. And that's that, you know, if there's a core message in the book, it's that especially when things are crazy, we all need refuge. We all need sanctuary. And the most convenient, accessible, and powerful and self-contained and protective sanctuary is within us, that we have a core of silence and a core of inner peace that is our essential nature. It is who we are. It is what is beneath all the craziness of our overactive minds and our out-of-balance bodies and our disconnected spirits. And when we have methods of accessing that, then we have our sanctuary within us. But I want to add just one thing, and I know you're going to bring it up, but I want to just say it right now to make sure. It is, we need a sanctuary in crazy times. We need to protect ourselves. But we also need to be engaged in the world. I am not presenting spiritual practices just as a way to evade and escape the craziness. It's a, these are methods to access our greatest strengths and bring them out without disturbing our own inner peace, so we can be better citizens as well.
Right, and that's really you know, the balance that you're talking about, and how different it is to actually have an inner framework. You know, in this materialistic society, where we grew up really in the first truly narcissistic generation, you know, where we were cultivated watching Howdy Doody as kids to buy Wonder Bread and have our mothers go do that for us. And, you know, we were cultivated as consumers, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's how it was.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah. And that's how rock and roll was born.
That's how rock and roll, exactly. You and me and Alan Freed, you know.
Alan Freed, right.
Yeah. And Alan Freed, the teenagers, or whatever. But the point I'm making is that in a culture where there is no inner life, then we become kind of hungry ghosts, and we're looking for everything out there. You mentioned that earlier, looking for happiness out there. And so in this cultivating an inner life, it creates a sense of nourishment, so that you can be more giving out there in the world, because you're getting, you're receiving from the inside out. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yes. Yes. And I would add to that, that when you have regular contact and an easy, accessible contact to your own inner peace, then you come out into the world and you can engage more compassionately, less selfishly, because you have a little more contentment. You have a little bit more clarity of mind. It's not just inner peace. It's also a feeling, sense of contentment, a sense of you don't need as much out there because you have some more contentment from inside. Doesn't mean you don't have any desires or preferences. That's nonsense. But it does mean you can come to the world with a more generosity of spirit, and your capacity for compassion and empathy might be better than it would have been without that inner dimension coming out of you. I've seen too many people. I saw it in myself back in the 60s. One of the reasons I turned to these Eastern teachings, I was busy being a political activist, and I was a mess inside. So how much, when I saw the people who wanted to bring about a revolution and how nuts we were, I thought, oh my God, the lunatics are going to be running the asylum if we succeed. There's got to be something more to this. And I see too many social activists burning out and losing their sense of balance and their composure. That's not good. You can't do your best work. You can't make your contribution, even if your contribution is just wanting to, you know, help your neighbors, let alone, you know, win an election or anything like that. We need to be at our best in order to bring our best to whatever contribution we want to make out in the world.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things, of course, that you, in cultivating that inner life, you know, you begin with meditation as a key practice. For people who have kind of well, you know, I'll do a yoga class here and there and maybe do a little meditation afterward. But I haven't really done it regularly. And maybe I don't have time, or it just seems like how do you begin a meditation practice and then keep yourself on it without going, oh, I keep my mind keeps wandering and all of that sort of stuff? How do you be kind to yourself while cultivating a practice that requires some discipline and focus?
Well, you really brought up you. I would have to essentially summarize two chapters of my book and an entire other books, because you know, first of all, there's the commitment. One of the things I've run into many, many times over the years, especially when things are nuts as they are now, is I know I should meditate, or I used to meditate and it really helped my life, but I don't have time for it now. And I always think, well, my first thought is always Mahatma Gandhi, who is said to have said on a particularly busy day in the morning, I have so much to do today, I'm paraphrasing, that I'm going to have to meditate for 2 hours instead of just one. And when you think about that, you realize there's a man who understood that meditation wasn't a luxury, it wasn't an indulgence, it was a necessary foundation for him being more effective in his work. And he had a lot to do. And so that's how I see it. And when people, if they have an effective meditation practice, which is a whole nother subject of, you know, how to find one and getting proper instruction, which I always recommend, even in my own book, I say, find a teacher to, you know, and learn directly from a teacher. But meantime, here's my book, so I'm going to give you some instructions. And there are instructions in the book for meditation. There's many sources. But I always advocate an easy form of meditation, not a rigorous one. We have to exert a lot of mind control and effort, because that will just make you frustrated if you do it on your own. Maybe okay if you do it under supervision. But if you're doing a practice on your own every day, as I recommend, that should be a gentle, easy practice, and one that produces some immediate effect of at least more calmness and relaxation at the end of it. And that reinforces the motivation for continuing to do it. People will find time when they realize something works for them. And to me, it didn't take long for me to see the value of it back in the 60s. And, you know, of course, I was lucky. I wasn't raising a kid. I don't even think I had a job at the time. So I could do it for long enough to see, oh, this stuff really works. It makes a difference in my life. So I'm going to make this a priority, just like I make, you know, taking a shower and going food shopping or changing the oil in my car. These are necessary maintenance. And
well, we're going to take another break, Phil.
Okay.
Right now, I see we're at time. Yeah. We'll come back and we'll talk about some other ways that you can maintain peace and sanity during these times. Steve Behrman will be back after these messages.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Well, we're back. We're back with Phil Goldberg, and we're talking about how to stay sane and grounded and peaceful during these times. In addition to meditation, what are some of the other practices that you found helpful?
Well, I try to be holistic in the book, and so I have mental practices like meditation and mindfulness and ways to work with perception, how we frame things, our attitudes, that sort of thing, cognitive things. And I also have physical practices, most of which have to do with I advocate doing physical yoga practices, although I would not teach stretching and bending practices because I feel it would be dangerous to try to do it in the book. But I have breathing practices, a number of them, practices having to do with from the Buddhist tradition for cultivating compassion. I also talk about in one chapter, the value, the importance of relationship, which is a little strange. I have a chapter on that, and I have a chapter on the use of sacred spaces to find safe harbor and sanctuary. Those things we have to be more creative about when we're being quarantined, essentially. Some of my most favorite sacred spaces, like hiking trails, are off limits now, and relationships take on a different dimension, and the importance of spiritual community and spiritual companionship, all these things are very important and can be adapted to, you know, the age of Zoom and telephone, remember telephones, and, you know, social distancing. So all of these things, plus a whole bunch of methods for what to do when you're disturbed. I mean, no matter how long I meditate and how many years I do yoga and everything, stuff happens. And, you know, you're shaking off balance and you watch the news or you hear somebody you love is sick or, you know, something happens at work or, you know, God knows what, there's tragic things going on every day. And you get angry, you get sad, you get worried. And there's ways to recapture our center and our stability and gain a measure of peace and clarity so we can respond more effectively to these upheavals. So there's a whole bunch of things such as, you know, just to give an example, when something upsetting happens, if we can just pause long enough to take a few deep breaths and exhale longer than our inhale, that there's a physiological shift that happens because of the extra exhale that brings us a little closer to our inner center, our peace. And also touching something, engaging the senses at that time sort of stops the mind from and the emotions from running away with us. And we can just come back to the present moment and center ourselves. And of all the senses, touch seems to be the most immediate. I think it's one of the reasons people would carry an amulet or a talisman with them, because when things happen, just gripping it, you know, keep something in your pocket or, you know, touch whatever is at hand. So there's a ton of practices like that, in addition to having a regular spiritual routine that it works for you, that to me the centerpiece would be some form of meditation, and then things to do before and after as you see fit. Plus, I have a whole chapter called Spiritual Time Management, where I give them guidelines for having essentially a repertoire of things. You can call them spiritual practices, you can call them just sort of mind-body interventions, things that work for you in whatever time you have at that moment, whether you have a minute or an hour or a day or more, to things you can draw on, like opening your pantry to see what's available for a snack. So there's a ton of stuff in there.
And what you're talking about is mindfulness, really. I mean, in the sense of taking the opportunity to actually be present. You know, people talk about multitasking. I find doing one thing at a time, I've had to relearn how to do that.
Yes, I know, me too.
You know, so speaking of all of that, what have you found most personally challenging during this particular crisis? And is there any particular one of your resources that you've found particularly helpful in dealing with that challenge?
Yeah, I have to first say that I'm one of the blessed ones, because most of my work, especially in this period of time, was going to be at home anyway. I have travel scheduled for book promotion and all that for August and September and October, and they may have to be canceled. But it's not. I was already scheduled to do certain things from home, and a couple of speaking engagements had to be canceled and all that. But it didn't upset my life on a daily basis. It did my wife's, who, as I told you, is an acupuncturist. But I'm lucky in that regard. So I have to say that one of the hardest things for me is the feeling that I can do more, that there must be something more I can do to help. And and I've embraced the fact that I have this book out, and I have some voice and something to offer from all my books and all my years of research. I've even started to take seriously my status as an elder. You know, I mean, we're in an age group where, you know, all of our years of experience must have taught us something, and we have something to offer. And so I try my best to, in my writing and whatever public access I have, like your show, to offer something to people in this crazy time. But then I watch the news and I see the suffering out there and the people on the front lines, and I feel, isn't there something else I can do? And that's been one of the hardest things for me, to be perfectly honest. What more can I do? Because I do take very seriously the fact that those of us who have some privilege and those of us who have something to offer and have the opportunity, we owe it to our neighbors and our fellow citizens to give something back. And so, frankly, the last chapter in my book is called Sacred Citizenship. And I felt that, you know, after when we're armed with a repertoire of spiritual practice, when we have a deep inner life, it would be the height of narcissism to just keep it to ourselves and be escapist in the midst of a crisis like this. So I think it's incumbent upon all of us to bring something more out into the world. And I've had to, you know, stretch myself to see what more I could do every day, because I could easily just say, you know what, I'm going to just watch Netflix and read some of the novels I've been waiting to have time to read. But I feel like, you know, we have to do more than that at this time. And I'm not always sure what I can do, you know. So
yeah, no, that's understandable.
That's a challenge.
And here, you know, here we have the perfect ironic and paradoxical situation that what people need is connection. And yet
yes.
We have to be physically disconnected. We have to cover our faces. Hey, look at how everybody in the world all of a sudden is honoring Muslim women. We're covering our faces, too, and
yes.
in respect for Muslim
yes.
women. You know, and so this is really a very challenging time. So we have got about 5 minutes left. Let's talk about it's been said before that crisis precipitates evolution. I know because I've said it. What do you see as the that's how I know it's been said before. What do you see as the evolutionary opportunity in this current political health and spiritual crisis that we're going through?
Well, you know, I did a Facebook Live about the positive outcomes that could come out of this. And so I made a list because, you know, it's very easy to get gloomy and the projections of, you know, death and illness that are ahead of us can easily lend itself to despair. But at the same time, I think, you know, if we can balance being real and realistic about what's going on and at the same time have some optimism and confidence, this is a real transformative opportunity. And I know there's a lot of spiritual people saying, oh, at the end of this, it's going to be a new world and a new age and a new paradigm and all this. And I think, well, yes, maybe it will be if we make that happen, because I don't think any of it is automatic. But it's if ever there was a big teaching about how interconnected we all are across the globe and how important people who have been given the low end of the short end of the stick, all these workers who are now being seen as heroes, the people bringing us our food and the people cleaning up and the people picking up the garbage and of course especially the people on the front lines of healthcare, maybe we'll treat them with more respect and reallocate our resources so inequality will be at least diminished, this crazy inequality. And maybe people will finally realize because they're forced to be alone and in solitude more, that there's joy to be had in the simple things of life. And maybe our frenetic consumerism and greed and materialism will, you know, finally more people will see through that and realize, you know, that being with other people and having relationships that are cultivated in and grounded in love and real strong connections and the inner connection, maybe more and more people will be able to be alone more and cultivate a spiritual life in a way that reduces the consumerism and craziness. Maybe we'll value our environment more because suddenly the skies in New Delhi and Detroit are cleaner. Maybe we'll see how fast nature recovers and we'll do something about climate change. So there's all kinds of ways that we can evolve a better world out of this, just as we did out of the Great Depression and World War II. We adapted. We made changes individually and collectively. So we could, if we learn the right lessons and we're conscious, do it. And I have to say that part of that equation will be what happens in November, because I think we need more conscious and creative leadership.
Political climate change is definitely what we need. And it's very complicated, of course. It's been wonderful talking with you, Phil, and particularly in looking at the possibilities that we have, you know, developing an inner life where perhaps you've been so busy out there that you haven't been able to do it. And actually, in this time out, in this reset, being able to determine what the most important things in life are. So I really appreciate the work and the play that you've done. I'm glad that we're friends. This is Steve Behrman on Wiki Politiki. We're talking with my good friend, Philip Goldberg, who has just published a book on how to spiritual practice for crazy times, which we're in. This is Steve Behrman. Thank you again, Phil. Hope to see you on the Funway. We're on Wiki
Politiki. Thank you, Steve.
We'll see you again. We'll see you soon, and back next week on Wiki Politiki.